My name is Katrine Judd, and I'm happy to announce our presenters. First, we have Karen Smythe. She is a fifth-year PhD graduate in American Studies at St. Louis University. She has a master's in American Studies from St. Louis University and the College of William and Mary. Her dissertation is entitled The Errand of Angels, Gender and Feminism in the Mormon Church, 1977 to 2014. And this is, happily, her second Sunstone. And we also have Michael Quinn, Dean Michael Quinn. He is a prominent historian. His next book will be The Mormon Hierarchy, Wealth and Business from the years 1830 to 2010. Michael was excommunicated in 1993, and he is also a gay father of four. So let's give him a welcome, and thanks for coming.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you for coming to this presentation. I'm excited to present this material to you because it's a new direction for my research, and thanks to Sunstone for the opportunity to present here, and especially for asking Mike Quinn to be the respondent. I'm looking forward to your comments and everyone's comments here. I gave a version of this presentation at Washington University in St. Louis to many religious scholars who know very little about the LDS Church. That is typically what I do, is I talk about my Mormon research to a lot of non-Mormons who know very little about it. So this is a very unique opportunity to get all of your feedback and hear your experiences. I look forward to the ensuing discussion and learning from all of you today. I began this project with the hypothesis that something changed in the general authority's rhetoric over time between 1995, with the Family Proclamation to the World, and 2012, MormonsandGays.org. My results proved this hypothesis incorrect, that very little doctrine or rhetoric had changed, but rather the medium has broadened, meaning the website received more press and traffic for non-LDS than general conference talks and Ensign articles. On September 23, 1995, Gordon B. Hinckley read the newly created The Family Proclamation to the World at the General Relief Society meeting. This proclamation, read at a meeting held biannually by and for the women of the church, declared that, quote, marriage between a man and a woman is ordained of God, quote, the family is the divine unit, and thus, quote, gender is an essential characteristic of individual, premortal, mortal, and eternal identity and purpose. The declaration restated much of the church's previous teachings and doctrine on gender and family, but it did so in a way that further reinforced traditional gender roles and left no question that traditional marriage was the only kind of marriage the church supported. Since the proclamation, many Mormon authorities have referred back to it as the hope for the future of nations, a clarion call to protect and strengthen families, and it remains central to official church doctrine on gender and sexuality. It is perhaps not surprising that given what it says in the proclamation, the church supported California's Prop 8 in 2008, which would have rendered same-sex marriage in California illegal. Many church members canvassed their neighborhoods, made millions of phone calls, and donated money in defense of what they considered traditional marriage. While the general authorities, like President Hinckley, remained silent on Prop 8, the message in the proclamation was clear, quote, we call upon responsible citizens and officers of government everywhere to promote those measures designed to maintain and strengthen the family as the fundamental unit of society. The church received a great deal of backlash from GLBTQ groups in the wake of Prop 8, I'm sure many of you remember, and some even controversially claim the church's fundraising efforts should make them ineligible for tax exemption, like the documentary 8 that was released in 2010, if any of you have seen that. Yet in 2012, 17 years after the proclamation and 4 after Prop 8, the church unveiled MormonsandGays.org, a website that is not official doctrine, but, quote, does reflect the feelings of church leaders as to how we should treat each other in regards to dealing with same-sex attraction, quote. The website claims to represent the official position of the church, but, quote, those who speak from the heart on this website do not necessarily represent in every word or detail the policies or positions of the LDS Church. This doublespeak is confusing, but I believe this demonstrates that the general authorities are conflicted in this matter, and they are leaving space for apostles to be more conservative or liberal on this issue. In this presentation, I look specifically at what Mormon general authorities have said regarding same-sex attraction to see what, if anything, has changed from 1995 with the Family Proclamation to 2012 when MormonsandGays.org was released. I use biannual conference talks and articles published in the Ensign to show how general authorities' rhetoric has changed, or if it has changed. The official position of the church on same-sex attraction, as laid out on MormonsandGays.org and in many conference talks over the years, is that the attraction is not wrong, but acting upon it is. The choice for homosexual Mormons is to either never act on those feelings or leave the church. This is why the church uses the term same-sex or same-gender attraction to delineate it from action, and I think that's an important distinction. They believe the humanity's purpose is in life is to stay true to Jesus' teachings while experiencing many earthly trials, and homosexual feelings are considered one of those earthly trials saints have to endure. The church's position on homosexuality has changed over time. It was first an aberration in the 19th century, an offense punishable by death or an act rather than a persuasion, then a crime in the early to mid-1900s, especially 1950s, then an illness or disease to be cured 1970s to 1990s, and finally, an attraction or feelings that are somewhat natural but cannot be acted upon while still a member of the church in good standing. The Family, a Proclamation to the World, cemented this view and is often considered doctrine. There was a really interesting discussion on, I believe it was Feminist Mormon Housewives or Ordained Supporters of Ordained Women, about if the family was actually doctrine or not. And the consensus ended up being that it was not officially doctrine, but it's treated as such. I used the doctrine definition by Bruce McConkie in his 1958 book, Mormon Doctrine, A Compendium of the Gospel. And that is, quote, the basic body of Christian teaching or understanding, and gospel doctrine is synonymous with the truths of salvation. It comprises the tenets, teachings, and true theories found in the scriptures. It includes the principles, precepts, and revealed philosophies of pure religion, prophetic dogmas, maxims, and views are embraced within its folds. The articles of faith are part and portion of it, as is every inspired utterance of the Lord's agents, which is a very important part of that definition. To complicate the matter, as many of you know, McConkie's book was controversial when it was first published because of the anti-Catholic sentiment within. In response, the First Presidency claimed it was an unofficial book, and from that point on made a rule no apostle could publish work without their prior knowledge and consent. Yet there's not really anything for a long time as comprehensive as Mormon doctrine, and it was treated as such for many years, went through three editions, and went out of print in 2010. Using McConkie's definition, I believe the Family, a Proclamation to the World, is indeed doctrine, and many, if not most, Mormons treat it so. On a recent trip to Nauvoo, Illinois, with Washington University, which was very fun, a small pamphlet of the proclamation was available at the LDS Visitor Center. Many of you have seen these pamphlets, and I was struck by the wording on the back of the pamphlet that explains, quote, the following proclamation is based on the teachings of Jesus Christ. In issuing the proclamation, Gordon B. Hinckley, president of the church, said, we command to all careful, thoughtful, and prayerful reading of this proclamation. The strength of any nation is rooted within the walls of its homes. We urge people everywhere to strengthen their families in conformity with these time-honored values, end quote. I thought that was particularly important as the only text on the back of the proclamation, and that was available for any visitor in the Nauvoo Visitor Center. When it was introduced at a Relief Society meeting, the Women's Auxiliary to the Priesthood, the Family Proclamation reworded previous understandings about gender and sexuality in the church, but some claim missed the opportunity to soften these claims and be sensitive to the needs of single, widowed, or GLBTQ Mormons. Since this proclamation was released, many apostles have given speeches and talks that reaffirm these principles over the years. And I was combing through the Ensign and General Conference records, and so I pulled out quotes that I thought were really important that reify the proclamation. For example, in 1995, Elder Dallin Oaks, who speaks about this topic more than any other of the apostles, I believe, said in an Ensign article in 95, quote, attraction between a man and a woman was instilled by the Creator to ensure the perpetuation of mortal life and to draw husband and wife together in the family setting he prescribed for the accomplishment of his purposes, including the raising of children. All of us have some feelings we did not choose, but the gospel of Jesus Christ teaches us that we still have the power to resist and reform our feelings as needed, and to assure that they do not lead us to entertain inappropriate thoughts or engage in sinful behavior, end quote. In 1997, President Hinckley said, quote, prophets of God have repeatedly taught that through the ages, the practices of homosexual relations, fornication, and adultery are grievous sins. Sexual relations outside the bonds of marriage are forbidden by the Lord, end quote. He further stated, we love those who experience homosexual attraction as sons and daughters of God. We want to help these people, to strengthen them, to assist them with their problems, and to help them with their difficulties. But we cannot stand idle if they engage in immoral activity, if they try to uphold and defend and live in the so-called same-sex marriage situation. To permit such would be to make light of the very serious and sacred foundation of God-sanctioned marriage and its very purpose, the rearing of families. In 1998, a suggestion by Elder Byrd in an Ensign article entitled, When a Loved One Struggles with Same-Sex Attraction, is for a faithful member to maintain, quote, a loving concern for the person with homosexual feelings, while, quote, reiterating the Lord's position that homosexual relations are sinful. The article then gives an example of a 40-year-old Mormon whose homosexual feelings mostly resulted from a childhood of horrific abuse. In 2001, Elder Boyd K. Packer, everyone knows him, explained in general conference to those who feel homosexual feelings that the church, quote, does not reject them and cannot reject them, for they are sons and daughters of God. The church cannot reject them because the church loves them. In 2004, the church released a statement saying they, quote, reach out with understanding and respect for individuals who are attracted to the same gender. We realize there may be great loneliness in their lives, but there also must be a recognition of what is right before the Lord. The church accordingly favors measures that define marriage as the union of a man and a woman that do not confer legal status on any other sexual relationship. In 2007, in the October edition of The Ensign, Elder Holland told a story of how he counseled a young Mormon man who struggled with same-sex feelings by explaining, quote, same-gender attraction is not a sin, but acting on these feelings is. As this young man hadn't violated the laws of chastity, Elder Holland was relieved and told him, quote, thank you for wanting to deal with this. It takes courage to talk about it, and I honor you for keeping yourself clean. You serve yourself poorly when you identify yourself primarily by your sexual feelings. You are first and foremost a son of God, and he loves you. In 2010, Elder Oaks again says, quote, young people struggling with any exceptional condition, including same-gender attraction, are particularly vulnerable and need loving understanding, not bullying or ostracism. In 2013, Elder Oaks, quote, we are correctly known as a family-centered church. Fortunately, many persons affiliated with other denominations or organizations agree with us on the nature and importance of traditional marriage, some on the basis of religious doctrine, and others on the basis of what they deem best for society. Our understanding of God's plan and his doctrine gives us an eternal perspective that does not allow us to condone homosexuality or find justifications in the laws that permit them. And unlike other organizations that can change their policies and even their doctrines, our policies are determined by the truths God has identified as unchangeable, which I think is particularly interesting for a church with continuing revelation. In 2014, Elder Neil Anderson in the May issue of Liahona said, while many governments and well-meaning individuals have redefined marriage, the Lord has not. He designated the purpose of marriage to go far beyond the personal satisfaction and fulfillment of adults to, more importantly, advance the ideal setting of children to be born, reared, and nurtured. Of special concern to us should be those who struggle with same-sex attraction. I want to express my love and admiration for those who courageously confront this trial of faith and stay true to the commandments of God. But everyone, independent of his or her doctrines or beliefs, deserves our kindness and consideration. So you can see over time, there's more emphasis on kindness and not the message of not bullying. In the Doctrine and Covenants, it states, quote, and I command you, preach not but repentance, and show not these things unto the world. For they cannot bear meat now, but milk they must receive. Wherefore, they must not know these things, lest they perish. I'm sure, and very familiar to you. I believe with MormonsandGays.org, general authorities are providing the milk instead of the meat. They specifically state on the website they will not engage with questions of what causes homosexuality or, quote, whether it is subject to change in kind or degree, and whether or the extent of which laws like marriage should accommodate it. Those are the important questions, I think. The general authorities on the website discuss only how their doctrine preaches tolerance, kindness, and love towards family and church members who struggle with same-gender attractions, and how their doctrine can, quote, help those members of the church who want to remain active and fully engaged. This is an important gesture from a church that has reaffirmed doctrinally, again and again through conference talks and published articles, that they will only support traditional marriage. Yet it's still milk and not meat. Many GLBTQ Mormons feel that this leaves them very little room in the church, stay and remain chaste, or leave. It's possible to change the doctrine, as an example is the June 1978 priesthood revelation, but the GAs have continued to support the doctrine regarding sexuality that was laid out in the proclamation throughout their conference talks. But many apostles before the 1978 revelation also supported doctrine that was against the revelation, even just a few years prior. It's possible to change. The fact that the church has living prophets that can continue revelation and change is probably what keeps many GLBTQ Mormons in the church, hoping for that change. While this presentation has just looked at a small slice of what the general authorities have said publicly about same-sex attraction and marriage, I plan to further this project by opening it up to groups like Affirmation, what homosexual members and former members say about their involvement with the church, other areas where homosexuality is policed, like the Honor Code at BYU, and what repercussions of this doctrine prior to MormonsAndGays.org has been on the youth and the homosexual youth in the church. I understand many of you have lived what I've chronicled, have experienced this, and I welcome your comments and suggestions. Thank you.
I'm Jared. I enjoy Karen Smythe's paper because I have not listened to talks in general conference, nor have I read the Ensign notes for decades.
I get the Ensign. I subscribe to the Ensign.
There has definitely, and I'm not saying this is a bad thing for people to do, even if they've been excommunicated, it's just I haven't. There has definitely been a softening of rhetoric about homosexuality, or as LDS headquarters prefers, quote, same gender attraction, unquote, since Bruce R. McConkie published Mormon Doctrine in 1958, and since the First Presidency approved a revised edition in 1966, which softened McConkie's rhetoric about the Catholic Church, but not about much else. In her tally of the Ensign's publications since 1995, I was surprised by Karen Smythe's finding that Apostle Dallin H. Oakes has spoken more about the topic than any other general authority. It was surprising to me. I was especially pleased to see the many examples where the general authorities have urged others to love and give comfort to those struggling, quote-unquote, with same-gender attraction. I was very... this reminds me of a interview that I had with Boyd K. Packer when I was being considered for employment by BYU. And he asked if I was having trouble with homosexuality, and I said no. I was very happy to see the quote of Elder Oakes urging the Latter-day Saints not to engage in ostracizing or bullying of people like me. While those of us who still identify ourselves as gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender appreciate the compassion in these talks and articles from 1995 to the present, I think that most of us disagree with what LDS headquarters has seemed to endorse as the substitute for the previous assumption that GLBT people choose to be so. Emphasizing the example of one male who was sexually abused as a child, then felt same-gender attraction as an adolescent and adult, is a statistically indefensible explanation for people like me. Like the vast majority of heterosexuals, the vast majority of persons defining themselves as LGBTQ did not experience sexual abuse as children. Although advocates of this explanation, emphasizing childhood abuse, see their approach as compassionate toward LGBTQ people, the argument of abuse is a fallback fallacy to avoid accepting the observation in the animal kingdom and in the human race that it is a natural occurrence in a small percentage of living things to be attracted to your same-sex kind and to seek mates in counterparts of the same sex. The evidence that Karen Smythe has presented shows that LDS headquarters and individual general authorities have taken steps toward easing the burdens of GLBTQ teenagers and adults who identify themselves as Mormon. And if anything is a choice for most teenagers and adults, it is whether to be Mormon or not, not whether to be gay or not. The effort would ease the guilt that LDS parents often feel if LDS headquarters also emphasized that same gender orientation or attraction is not caused by distant fathers and overly protective mothers. Statistically, about the same percentage of heterosexuals complain about being raised by distant fathers and difficult mothers. Furthermore, it would really ease the burdens and tragedies of LDS teenagers if LDS general authorities specifically and often encourage parents not to banish their children who admit to being to feeling same-gender attraction. In sum, Karen Smythe's work shows the encouraging trend of compassionate discourse from LDS headquarters about same-gender attraction since 1995. However, her work also shows, often by the absence of emphasis in this discourse, that general authorities have not gone far enough in overcoming the belief of teenagers and adults that LDS headquarters wishes that GLBTQ people weren't around to frighten the faithful. Thank you.
Does it work now?
Yes.
We have time for questions, so if you have any questions, please come use this mic so we can pick it up for recording. And please ask away.
Thank you for your comments. That was amazing, and it's nice to see both of you here. I'm wondering if you could talk a little bit about the Mormon Building Bridges movement and how that fits in with what you've observed.
Okay. That is something that I'm still learning about. This is the new direction that my research is going into. Normally, I've studied a lot about gender and women and Mormon feminism. And so actually, I don't know enough about that other than what I've heard being at Sunstone and meeting people who are involved with the Building Bridges movement. My idea for starting this research was just this thought in my head when Mormonsandgays.org was released. I thought, oh my gosh, that's a huge step. They must have changed, the general authorities must have changed something. There must be something really different there. And they must be building bridges and trying to ease the struggles of gay Mormons. And then in actually reading the rhetoric and looking at what was said, I realized that, like Mike said, they are encouraging and softening a little bit, but because it's so laid out black and white in Family and Proclamation to the World that gender is essential and this is traditional marriage is the only thing, that I don't know how they're going to really build those bridges without coming up with some kind of amendment. I'm really interested to hear any suggestions that you all have for how they might go on moving forward. I was asked at Washington University when I gave a different version of this talk, they said, well, do you think that's ever going to change? And I said, well, they have continuing revelation, so we'll see. But gender and sexuality being so central to the doctrine and theology, I really am not sure how that could change. Would you like to add anything?
Well,
Only one thing is that they certainly have dug themselves into a very deep hole on this issue and have made it difficult to even give a nod to the scientific data about the occurrence in a small group of the animal or a small percentage of the animal kingdom. And in that respect, I recommend a book called Natural Exuberance, which looks at the occurrence of same-sex behavior and attraction in the animal kingdom. But even though they've dug themselves into a hole or painted themselves into a wall or whatever parallel you want to make or metaphor you want to make, the general authorities in the 19th century, and particularly from the 1880s onward, did the same thing about polygamy. And in fact, the apostle who said that the church would never abandon the practice of plural marriage, and that if it did abandon it, it would be a sign that the church had gone to the devil, was Wilford Woodruff, who in fact, a few years later, issued the proclamation that abandoned the practice of plural marriage. So things are possible, as Karen has pointed out, in an organization which emphasizes as a priority the ability of God to make wonderful changes to Revelation.
There's something that is becoming more and more understood with the actual problem, unrelated to this, but it's ordaining women, that there is a relationship, but not a direct relationship, between church headquarters here in Salt Lake and the organizational elements throughout the world that are based on the stake and ward. And when we observe what was happening with ordained women, where state president could take it on himself, what you're dealing with is personal bias in many instances. Part of the change that you're looking for may come from church headquarters, as it did in 1978 with the announcement that the blacks could hold the priesthood for the first time since Brigham Young's decision. And you may find that there has to be an educational process that reaches all the way down to the stake and ward level before you'll see any significant change coming from headquarters. They're not a hierarchy where they just release an edict and all of a sudden everything happens. Because even with these other changes you've cited, it was years afterwards and many people leaving the church based on those announcements. One thing that I would suggest is something that we've been hearing lately about LGBT and the idea of even though you have these feelings, that it would be appropriate for you to marry a woman anyway, even though you're not attracted to her. And the response that I'm hearing now is to suggest to the bishop or the state president who's making that pronouncement that would it be appropriate to marry your daughter?
That's an excellent point. I know a lot of the supporters of ordained women have talked about Bishop Roulette and how it just depends on if you have a bishop who is open-minded or compassionate or supports feminism or ordained women or not. I know many people in the wake of Kate Kelly's excommunication have lost their temple recommends or their callings, and I think that that's true. From a academic standpoint, I tend to really think of the church as all top-down, and there is a lot of truth and evidence to that, but it does depend on your local stake, your local ward, your bishop.
I know in San Francisco, there's an openly gay, is it a church secretary, I think, if anyone knows. And, yes. Oh, yeah, he can't be here. Is that right? He was supposed to be here yesterday. And so there's a softening in different places, especially maybe in an area like San Francisco where homophobia doesn't really have a toehold in that region. So I think there can be a softening from that level, and maybe that's what will convince them to be different. I know a lot of millennials like myself feel very compassionate and feel like an ally to GLBT, or you know, we are GLBTQ. And many people are leaving the church over that. I think Prop 8 was such a polarizing time for many people. Many of you have heard other people this Sunstone talk about how Prop 8 was really a turning point for them. And that's something that I didn't even really get into with this paper, since I was just looking at the rhetoric of the general authorities. And I thought it was interesting that they were mostly quiet around Prop 8 in conferences and in lectures. I thought that was, yet other leaders were saying we should go and support traditional marriage. So that is also kind of an interesting shift.
Is this on?
Yes.
I'd like you to maybe comment on a series of things. The first thing, in the Proclamation of the Family, it says that gender is eternal, which means it should be universal. As a therapist, since I've seen transgender people, and I've also seen people that were born with both sexual parts, that inconsistency, that it doesn't apply, particularly from a church that believed in non-traditional marriage at one point, it does not apply or explain the variance of gender that we see in this law. Secondly, and I may be wrong, the way I read Dallin Oaks, but I got it out of the Tribune, was that he said that even if gay, lesbian people married and were legally married, they were still immoral and would be considered so, which gives no, even if we move, which I think we will, to a civil rights and a good position of marriage equality, they're still in a bind of not being able to be anything but immoral, even within the legal laws of the land. And maybe I misheard that. And then the third thing is, I've had a number of patients like from BYU, and I understood that this was their stance, it may have changed recently, was yes, we treat them just like heterosexuals, except they are not allowed any outward affectional signs. So they can't, they're not supposed to associate with other gay, lesbian people. They are not to show holding hands or kissing, nothing publicly, which is still a message that they are wrong and makes the standard between heterosexual and gay, lesbian people wholly unfair in my way of thinking. So you can correct me if my thinking is wrong, if what I've heard and read is incorrect. I guess the fourth thing is, I've been shocked how many people recently, including a couple I talked to here, that somebody snapped a picture of them, he has a gay brother, and he and his wife were marching in the gay pride parade. They were called in, released from their callings, and told that they were not allowed to interact with the youth. And I've been shocked how many people at this conference I've talked to have recently faced church discipline by being more friendly or taking a stance for marriage equality. So I don't know if that goes together.
There's one thing I wanted to mention as a newspaper report concerning this issue of the eternality of gender as stated in the proclamation to the family. I think it was after the proclamation was issued, but it was while I was living in Salt Lake City in the 1990s that this question of gender came up. It may have been before the proclamation, but the Salt Lake Tribune interviewed a physician in the Wasatch area, I believe it was a Salt Lake physician, who specialized in giving treatment and surgical treatment and maternity treatment for newborns. And he said that he himself had performed hundreds over a 3-decade period, hundreds of sex reassignment surgeries in the delivery room of children who had been born within the Wasatch Front with both male and female genitalia. And this is not such a rare kind of occurrence for the general authorities to just simply ignore when one physician has had that kind of experience in performing sex reassignment surgeries in the birthing room in a hospital. So there are a number of problems with the proclamation on the family and the general conclusion that it is God's revelation or doctrine, and this is just one of them.
Thanks for that comment. I think in all those things you are not wrong, and I think that the apostles tend to think in binaries. There is no gender spectrum, and that's what the proclamation is. It is binary: man, woman, families, children. There's no room for a spectrum. That's why I think the proclamation is so, it can be so damning and difficult, because there's just no room in there. And I think that partly, and this is just my opinion, partly because the general authorities are so much older, are of older generations. I mean, maybe they're not getting all the information. Maybe they don't, they didn't read the Tribune article. But there has been extensive research on how that kind of sex reassignment surgery as an infant can be damaging to the individual growing up if they feel that they were reassigned to the wrong sex. And I've often thought with transgender individuals in the church, I thought, well, what's one way that Mormons could do some mental acrobatics and get around that? What could that be? Maybe they were born in the wrong body and that's their earthly trial. Maybe that's because they could go from one binary to another, maybe. So gender being eternal, I think, is really difficult. I wanted to mention another thing to one of your points, is that the laws of the land don't count. There's something that I read in my paper where it was saying, we will not recognize this marriage, same-sex marriage, because it is not correct. I mean, even when Hinckley is being nice, he says the so-called same-sex marriage situation. I mean, the rhetoric is dismissive and it's rude to me. And I forgot your last point, but I agree with a lot of it.
You spoke of the church's website, MormonsEngaged.com, that was released 2 years ago. Now, in my Mormon circles in the Wasatch, there seems to be very little reading or acknowledgement of that website, even among my church leaders. Are you aware of any examples, even anecdotal ones, of stake presidents throughout the country or the world that have taken that website and made it a theme of a major presentation, state conference, etc., and use that as an invitation to educate the congregants in his own stake? And of course, at your option, you might want to reflect this question back on the audience here at large if they have an anecdotal example. Thank you.
That's a great question. I don't know. I knew about Mormons and gays.org because of the non-Mormon press about it. I think that the church has become increasingly, incredibly savvy, PR savvy, and savvy online. And I think that I don't know anyone who's looked at it. And you know?
I got a phone call from my brother. I'm gay. And on June 1st, and he said, "You're not going to believe what our Sunday school was." He said they had it was a high priest and elders quorum is what it was, meeting combined, and they talked all about Mormons and gays.org, and he said he was so excited about it. And the whole tone was, you know, we need to be kind, we need to be loving. And he said, and they were saying, well, we need to love and be kind to people who have beliefs that are different than ours. And he said, I couldn't stand it anymore. He said, I raised my hand and I said, no, these are people who have the exact same beliefs that we do. They believe exactly as we do, and they're trying to figure out how to fit in and how to navigate that. And in the Oakland stake, they're doing a lot of things like that in Oakland, California. You've probably talked about that.
I have not, but I also wanted to point out that the website MormonsandGays.org is not a very big website. It's pretty small. There's a bunch of videos from members identifying as GLBT, gay and lesbian, really, and how they overcame it and how happy they are. And it's propaganda. And then there's, you know, Dallin Oaks talking about the same stuff he's talked about in conference, and there's a couple other things, and that's it. So that's why I say it's milk and not meat, because I thought, oh, this is great, and I actually looked through it and thought, that's it?
No, yeah, it totally sucks, but at least it starts a conversation.
That's true. That's true.
Probably should have just let that in the holder, all the trouble it took me to get it out. Regarding the Mormons and Gay website, my friend Kurt Bench, he's a friend of a lot of us, once said, if you want to hide something from the Mormons, publish it. I think he was up to something. I'm LDS, and I'm straight. And I want to go on record as saying that I 100% stand behind the right of any religious organization, including the LDS Church, to set whatever membership requirements that they want for people in their groups. That said, I really hope and pray that the LDS Church, my church, will change. I see some movement in that direction. But I think Michael was right when he said that we've dug such a deep hole, it's going to be very, very difficult to get out. Now, having said that, I think that it's immoral for any church or any organization to want to deny people basic civil rights. And as we see the prohibitions against same-sex marriage, gay marriage, falling across the country, and I think eventually the Supreme Court will do that, to not I won't say embrace, because they still have the right as far as the membership is concerned, but to be actively preaching against those things which are the legal law of the land, to me is immoral. I'll sit down in a minute. I wanted to ask you, Karen, in your research, when you were doing the research on whether or not the proclamation was doctrine or not, did you also look at people, did the people feel that the proclamation was revelation or not? And the last thing that I'll say is, if you're interested in Mormons building bridges, the very next session down in the Salt Air will be for Mormons building bridges. I affiliated myself with them a couple of years ago. I walked I crawled practically in the parade this year,
yeah.
And I have to say, it was the most spiritual Sunday I've spent in the last 45 years.
Thank you for those comments. I think you're right about if you want Mormons to ignore something, publish it. Although, that's not always the case, right? Right. So it just depends on what you're saying, I guess. And as a non-LDS and never-mo, I like to call myself a Mormon scholar, I think it does depend on what I publish and what I say. And for me, it's finding that balance between apologetics and, you know, Lighthouse Ministries. So, what was I going to say? I think that walking in the parade, I've heard from many people in a lot of the groups I'm affiliated with on Facebook, the LDS Supporters of Ordained Women and Feminist Mormon Housewives, about how when you practice that kind of loving kindness and that kind of support, they really, a lot of them felt the spirit, a lot of them felt what they were doing was right. And it's an interesting contrast to what you're hearing from the general authorities, because you're supposed to be obedient, but yet also follow your free agency and feel the burning in your bosom that something's right. And so I think there's lots of conflicting messages there. I also think that if they really come out and say very specifically, we are going to not recognize gay marriage, that obviously is something that is being fought out very publicly as more and more states allow gay marriage. That's going to get them in trouble. I don't know how they're going to be able to do that. So we'll see.
Great. So Karen, if you're a never-mo, I'm a post-mo. It was over 25 years ago that I kind of had my faith crisis, and I came to Sunstone quite a lot. And Mike, I read almost all of your books. And then I kind of drifted off and didn't care anymore. And during those 20 years when I was kind of away, I met a lot of people in my life who were gay or lesbian. And I got to know them, and they were real and in my life. And that experience of loving kindness that you can offer to another human is indeed wonderful. Prop 8 woke me up. And at age 50, I turned in my resignation papers 4 days after Prop 8 passed, because the church that I was raised in, it was enough to make me an activist about this. I felt that strongly, that the church was mistaken in meddling in the law of the land, especially two states over. And ever since then, I have been reawakened to things Mormon. And I'm an active member of the post-Mormon organization in the Wasatch Front, and it is wonderful. So I didn't get up, that's just a preamble. What I actually wanted to ask you about is the law of the land is being challenged right now with regard to marriage equality. And Utah, ironically enough, may be the spearhead at the front of this, because they're so against it and keep spending a lot of tax dollars to go defend this. What I'm wondering about, what I want you to offer your observations on, both of you, is the church's strong stance with regard to this seems to be bringing them more and more to the forefront in the news, and to the point of considering changing long-held policies in four countries on the planet of not allowing people to marry in the temple if they've married civilly. They can't get a sealing done unless they've waited a year after a civil marriage. And there's strong rumors out with quite a lot of evidence that the church is actually considering removing marriage the marriage ceremony from the temple and only doing sealings, forcing people to get married civilly. So I'm just curious if you had any observations about kind of the impact on the marriage equality movement legally on the church and what you think those impacts will be.
Well, I too have heard those rumors, and there is lots of substantial evidence that that is the case. I think that all this pressure has to do something, has to get to the general authorities and through the iron gate of the PR department. It has to get to them to understand there is a lot of bad press. It's like ordained women. You know, so many TBMs saying, well, ordained women gives the church bad press. It's saying, well, who's really giving the bad press? And you know, these PR, these lies and these PR statements, or you know, what's really happening there? So, I think was there not a lot of outside influence that influenced the 1978 decision? Probably, and most likely, I'm sure more people can speak to that definitively, but. I think it'll take a lot of time. I think it'll have to go for a little while and get, you know, almost every state supporting same-sex marriage. Many people ask me, a lot of non-Mormons say, well, do you think women are ever going to be ordained? Because I talk about that a lot, and I have a profile on ordained women. I'm the second Nevermo on ordained women. And I say, you know, I don't know, because sexism is so entrenched in our society that I don't know that there'll ever be that kind of push. Like there was during the time of civil rights, where we now people my age and younger and hopefully a little bit older than I am, believe that calling someone or if someone's racist, it's almost like calling them a Nazi. I mean, it's just a horrible thing to say. Whereas that wasn't always the case, you know, a couple generations ago. And so I hope in the future, calling someone sexist or saying someone is homophobic will have the same connotations. And I think it just takes time. Also, I read a great article that was saying that children who read Harry Potter are more more likely to support or be allies to gays and lesbians. And I thought, oh, good. Well, that was one of the best-selling, you know, books, and hopefully lots of Mormon children have read Harry Potter. And maybe J.K. Rowling is the one that's gonna change our country.
Interracial marriage was forbidden in many, many states in the United States in the early 20th century. It had been allowed in northern eastern states even in the 19th century, but even as of 1900, the vast majority, I think something on the order of 3/4 of America, prohibited same-sex marriage. It was prohibited in Utah, not same-sex, excuse me, interracial marriage. And it was prohibited in Utah despite the liberalization of one state after another allowing interracial marriage. It remained illegal in Utah until the Supreme Court decision in 1967 in Loving versus Virginia. And so it required a Supreme Court decision before a African-American and white American were allowed to marry in Utah, but it also included the marriage of Asian Americans and white Americans, which were also prohibited and could not be sealed in the temple. And so as much as I would like to see and like to think that compassion governs many of the policies as implemented and as changed. In some cases, it's only when the law of the land changes in a dramatic way, in many cases by the Supreme Court, that compassion works in Protestant congregations, in Catholic, and in Mormon.
Okay, in order to finish on time, this will be our last question. And if you want to meet Michael or Karen, feel free to do so in the hall or out in the area so that they can get ready for the next session. Thanks.
To Roy, I marched in these Mormon Building Bridges parades, and they really are wonderful. If you haven't done it, it would be a good thing to do. I highly recommend it. And as far as the state president's examples of that, my state president hasn't done that, but I have gone in and talked to Billy and suggested that. And I think we all have the power maybe to do things in our own communities in our own ways to try to further the cause. I think the grassroots efforts can help. My state president, he liked the idea. He's thinking about it. I secretly knew that he had a gay son that he hadn't told me about. My daughters have told me about that. So I think he may be a little more open to that as a possibility. But I had a question about the proclamation on the family, and part of the impetus.
I can't hear you.
Is this better? I just had a question about the proclamation on the family and the motivation that they caused them to generate that. And in particular, I know there was legislation in Hawaii that was going on that motivated some of that thought. But there was also some articles about a gay gene there was a lot of hype about that in the early 90s. I'm wondering if you have any background or knowledge about that, and if you think that may have been part of the motivator towards the proclamation.